Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. This is my dad, Ted.
And the last few weeks, I have interviewed a few people. And today, on this episode, I want to share with you a conversation I had with Dr. Jared Horvath, who is in Australia. He is a neuroscience and educator. He's a best-selling author, and he's an expert in the field of the science of learning. He has a new book out that he co-authored with David Bott, which is called 10 Things Schools Get Wrong. And in this conversation with Jared, we talk a little bit about a few of the things that he believes they get wrong. But here's the deal. The book also tells us how we can get them right. And the book tackles many of the key traditional practices that we have in schools. So take a listen to Jared and I as we talk about his newest book, 10 Things Schools Get Wrong and How We Can Get Them Right. It's a fascinating conversation because I always have fun with it. Jared lives in Australia. I live in Wisconsin in the United States. And when I'm talking to him, it's yesterday in his world. Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast, everyone. I'm here today with Dr. Jared Horvath. He's coming to me. It is 8:20 a.m. in the morning by him and 5:20 p.m. the day before I'm talking to him, which is just fascinating to me.
Makes technology good. This is where, of all the tech things in the world, this is the one that I can get behind because we can talk across the world in real time.
Right. And we're looking at each other, which is even weirder. But yeah. Dr. Horvath is an expat. He is from the United States. He lives in Melbourne, Australia with his wife and teaches there. And he'll get into that a little bit. But today we're here. He's a three-time guest on the Smart Thinking Podcast. Today, we're here to talk about his new book that he collaborated with David Bott on called 10 Things Schools Get Wrong and How We Can Get Them Right. And Jared, what we're going to do is we're going to look at five of the things that we get wrong. And I'm just going to kind of rapid hit you with questions here. But I want to start out with how I felt when I read your book.
I'm scared now.
Yeah, no, but every parent, every teacher, every educator, leader that should read this book, because I read it from a defensive position. You go through this text and you take apart everything that I have been tuned, educated, and advocated for, as well as created compliance measures around doing in schools. So have you gotten feedback like that from other people?
Yeah, it's what we tend to see is people, it's similar to you, they come in thinking, I'm going to be angry. And they'll start a chapter, they say, by being like, oh, this is going to be nonsense. This is going to be bollocks. And typically by the end of each chapter, they're like, okay, I agree with what I can see where you're coming from. And it actually helps me kind of reassess what I'm doing. So we tried not to be just pure attack, because you've read those books, which are just like, education sucks. Schools are broken. We need to change everything. And we're like, no, our biggest premise is education isn't broken. It's 85% of everything we do is fine. We wouldn't get to where we're at if education was as decrepit as people think it is. It's just, how do we tweak small things to make it that last 15% even better and continue to evolve it? So hopefully, you came in defensive, did you leave defensive or did you think?
Oh, no, not at all. And that's the thing. Like I told you, you're the antagonist, you know, you're the challenger. Like, come on, you guys, think about what you're doing. Our practices are so ingrained, you know, and everybody jokes about it. You could step into a classroom in 1910 and 2021, and the only difference would be like the color of the walls and some technology pieces. And you do a masterful job, like breaking down, like, yeah, those computers, not making that big of a difference, and some other pieces. Yeah. But one of my favorite quotes in here was when you're talking about the expertise of teachers and people's perceptions. And I just want to read it. It's in the first chapter under expertise, and you're talking about how, like, in education, there's just kind of a lack of, you know, recognition that we should have other teachers talking to us instead of, you know, bringing in outside people and Daniel Pinks and businessmen and women to talk to us about how we should get better. We should be looking at our practitioners. And you wrote in here, you and David wrote in here, it's a quote. It says, I am a parent, coach, boss.
I teach every day. So that means we're all teachers. And you, and this is what I love about your book, because there's just a little touch of sarcasm in it. Most people brush their teeth every day, which means at some level, we are all dentists. Nobody makes the argument, however, because it's recognized that dentists perform the act of dental cleaning more effectively and efficiently and with far more technical knowledge than the average person. And which basically you're implying, like, stop pretending you're teachers and get moving.
Bingo. So, you're not a, it's, I've made that mistake myself. Is at some level, everyone does teach. There's no mistake. If you've ever spoken to another human being, you teach. But that doesn't make you a teacher. And that certainly doesn't make you an expert at teaching. So unless you want to call yourself, like, it's a good point. I went to the dentist last week. I brush my teeth, but I don't know what the heck that person is doing. I watch TV, so I know what actors do. I've never acted a day in my life. I wouldn't presume to. But just because I've been to school and seen teachers teach, I presume, oh yeah, no, I know what they do. We don't. Teaching is a unique profession. It is a specific thing in its own right that you can develop expertise in. And we've just got to start recognizing that, yeah, no, the only experts in teaching are going to be teachers themselves. They can't be outsiders just talking about the craft. It's insiders performing the craft. Those are the ones we need to listen to.
Yeah, it is the one profession where universally everyone has been in school. So yeah. Everyone has sat there and critiqued and stared at an educator. Therefore, we all think we're an expert. It's like if you, I played football, but I certainly couldn't coach a professional football team, whether you are listening in England and you think that's soccer, or in the United States and you think that's American football. So Jared, talk to me a little bit about what were some of your findings in chapter one, you know, the expertise, the problem with experience. What were some of your ahas or things that the listeners should be paying attention to?
I think the big stuff in that is when you really boil down what is expertise, when you start to differentiate between what makes an expert versus just a lay person. And when you start to see it's a thought process, it's a work process, it's a life process. And by the very definition of what it means to become an expert, there is no other expert in teaching other than teachers. But what happened, and this is, I think, the big kind of breakthrough here, is what we've done through education in the last, say, 2 decades, is we've conflated learning with teaching. And totally understandably, the two work in the very same sphere, but believe it or not, they're totally different. You can know a ton about learning and have no clue how to teach. And if you don't believe me, just go to uni right now and work with any of the professors I work with. Guns on learning, horrible lecturers and teachers, just trash. Or you can be an incredible teacher and have no clue about learning, hence the last 2,000 years of education. But what we've done is we've conflated the two and we've put teaching under learning. So now all of our professional learning, all of this, brings in scientists who are good at learning. Here's how human beings learn. And they assume that's going to answer the question of, how do I teach people that? And it doesn't. And the only answer to how do I teach is going to come from the experts in that craft, which are teachers themselves. So kind of like what you were alluding to, if you go to a police officers conference right now, 80 to 90% of all the speakers will be active policemen talking about what they do. If you go to a law conference, there'll be lawyers talking about what it means to be a lawyer. You go to a teaching conference, 90% will be academics talking about learning with no comment or understanding whatsoever on what that means to teach grade 3 math with 50 kids on a Friday afternoon. So that's where, if we can start to recognize the difference between learning and teaching and separate the two and recognize there are different experts in each field, maybe then we can start to have better conversations and recognize again, nobody does what teachers do other than teachers. Let's give them the credit for that.
And I love the point in the chapter where it's like, we're one of the few professions that tries to look outside of the profession to try to figure out a way to make us better within the profession, while at the same time, that is a significant waste of time, energy, and effort.
Well, it's the cutting edge problem. So I spend most of my time now doing neuroscience. And when you're in neuroscience at our level, you're at the cutting edge. The answers to all the questions we have in neuroscience can only come from us and the data we generate. There is nothing else in the world we can turn to other than us. It's the same thing with teaching. Teaching is now at the cutting edge. We've been doing it for thousands of years. But rather than recognizing and starting to develop a system whereby we say, yeah, the only answers are going to come from us on the ground doing the work, we start looking, yeah, to business people and to lawyers and politicians and, hey, this guy was nice. Let's go ask him how to teach. And there's nothing there because nobody, they're not the ones generating the data that's going to lead to the next breakthrough. So it's once we start recognizing you, if I ever get to go to a teaching conference where 90% of people are teachers, that's what I'm going to say. That's what needs to be happening. They just broke through the barrier. It's teachers talking to teachers about their expertise. That's what it needs to be.
And what's interesting is, so we run professional conferences and we do an event where we have a couple thousand teachers participate and they can rotate through different sectionals. And so many times they will go to motivational people. They will, like me, like I'm, part of my job is to, you know, create those conditions for people to, you know, think about leadership and their influence.
Yeah.
But they will walk right past a room of like English teachers, and they're an English teacher, to go to the person to talk about how to, you know, support, you know, classroom management or maybe mental health or different things like that.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get people to sit in a room to talk about their craft. So what do you
make sense? If you go to, I mean, take a look at the sciences too. We're very similar in that if you go to a neuroscience conference, it's all neurosciences scientists talking about research, but we all hate each other. Well, we don't hate each other, but it's very defensive. Like all you're doing is thinking that's bullshit, or, oh no, that's not, or, oh, I would change that, or you don't know this data. And even when you're just sitting listening, you're still trying to one-up each other. And so maybe that's what leads teachers to go, I don't need to know that because I already know it. But in truth, that cesspool of kind of anger and confusion and trying to one-upsmanship is where the evolution comes, is the act of sitting there listening to somebody and scowling and going, oh, this guy doesn't know what I know. Believe it or not, that is helping you solidify your positions and come up with the next idea to how to either prove this person wrong or incorporate what they've done. So I think a lot of people assume, and rightly, teachers, I know what I'm doing. You absolutely do. But does that mean we can't improve? No. And that improving feels typically really hard. And it's only going to come from battling, going head to toe against other people doing the exact same thing you are, and maybe acknowledging, dang it, that person did it better than me, or I need to prove this person wrong. That's where the next evolution comes from. And it rarely feels good. So I totally understand why most teachers would be like, I'm going to go to the good feel good session rather than the one that's going to make me go, that's
well, and again, that's what your book did for me and many other people who I suggested this to, like, who is this guy I think he is? And then you start reading, you're like, oh, now I get it. So you just described something that it would be one of the things that we actually encourage people to do is to go to conferences for their own development outside of their field.
Yeah.
So like I would geek out at a neuroscience convention or training or a learning opportunity. Just because the whole time I'd be thinking to myself, they all think I'm a neuroscientist.
Yeah, yes, I'm one of you now. And yeah. It's good. To be fair, though, that's where a lot of creativity, well, at least not creativity in the sense of development, but let's just say broader thinking will come from getting outside of your field. And that's why I sit in six different fields and I absolutely love it. But true development, creativity within your field. So creativity, a lot of people think that means... like kind of a free-for-all, invent new stuff. In truth, creativity requires a box. You cannot think outside of a box until you are very, very aware and cognizant of the box itself. And that's where most teachers, they're really good at the box. And so they think creativity is going to be breaking outside of that box by going to another field. And you might get ideas there, but where true creativity comes is when you now bring those ideas back in and you use that to start physically changing whatever techniques, tools, tips you do. And most of those changes you'll see won't have come from the neuroscience. They will have come through your lens as a teacher, interpreting it, redefining it, moving it into your terms and language, and then playing with it in a way that by the time you actually come up with something that's creative and teaching, it is so different than what you would have gotten at that neuroscience conference that all of them would have said, I never told you that. I never said anything close to that. But that's where you start to, when you're working in your own field, that's where we get creativity, where things kind of become translated into our language. That's when it makes sense.
That's awesome. So let's flip over to chapter 3 then in your text. One of the things that I struggle with as an educator, a father, a spouse of a teacher is grades.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, being a C student was where most of us were. We were graded on curves. and you'd move up a little bit. You know, if somebody in the class did, if everybody in the class did poorly on the test, the teacher just moved it to where it needed to be to have the bell curve, and you could get through life with a 2.0. Today, you go into the local newspapers, and when they publish the honor roll, it's an 8 font, and almost everybody's on it. Then you have school districts who are working hard to do standard-based grading alignment, where they are getting they are eliminating grades, and they are then aligning it to your ability to demonstrate your skills on assessments, and they're taking out all of the emotion and different pieces of compliance. And in the meantime, that is convoluted because one school district does it that way and another doesn't do it that way. And then when your children want to go to college, technical school, or in the workforce, GPAs are put up on a board and compared to each other. And as we learned as a family, scholarship money at the university is based upon your GPA, not your standardized tests. So a B is not a B is not a B, and an A is not an A is not an A. And if you're a C student, you're in trouble, where that's not the case. So when I read that chapter for you guys from you two, I was like, I'm all in. So tell us a little bit about kind of what your findings were, and you know, you're, again, the antagonist here, but what was your kind of findings and suggestions around grading?
I love it. So if you take everything you've just said about grades, the one important thing to recognize, and I think this is the big take home from grades, is nothing you've mentioned has anything to do with learning. You never out of your mouth said, was the grade driving this? Did this help me learn math? Did this help me read better? Grades inherently, they have no value when it comes to learning. They're completely separate from that craft or from that endeavor. So what you start to do, and what we did in this chapter, is you kind of dig out the philosophies. What do grades say about the world? When you break grades down, they have a three-step philosophy about how the world works. Reify, quantify, rank. So reify means to turn something that's not real into something that is real, an idea, an ethereal, a concept into a noun. So in this case, most of those reifications are going to be things like intelligence, creativity, knowledge. None of these things are actually, you can't dig up intelligence in a garden, but a grade requires you to say, no, here is what I mean when I say intelligence. Once you've reified something like intelligence, then you can quantify it. You can assign a value to it. That's a 6 out of 10 on creativity. That's a 2 out of 10 on intelligence. Why would you want to quantify? Because then you can rank. This is funnier than this. This is smarter than this. This is more creative than this. At the end of the day, that's all grades intend to do. They are a ranking system. They reify, quantify so they can rank individuals. Now, that in itself, I guess, isn't bad. I mean, maybe ranking is fine, I guess. But the question is, then you say, ranking for what? What are we ranking kids for? If grades serve, the entire purpose of grades is just to rank, what are we doing that for? And the only reasonable answers you can come out with are to get kids into college or to get kids into the job force. At which point you then pull back and go, wait a second, I was a high school teacher for 5 years. Why the heck was it ever my job to rank kids for a university? A university which makes billions of dollars a year in profit. I need to spend my time, my effort, my 4 years with my students sorting them out for that juggernaut? Screw that. Your dime, your time. You take care of the ranking just like Google. When Google wants to hire people, let them take care of the ranking. If my job as an educator and the primary function of school is learning, then we eliminate anything that doesn't correlate with learning, that has no impact on learning. And in this instance, you recognize grades are totally outside exterior thing for us. Scrap those and you're fine. You can focus back on learning. And that's where you start to come back to what you're talking about, the standards alignment. I think a lot of them are recognizing a standards alignment is by and large binary. I don't need to, if you're driving by, now, and I think this is important to point out before I go into that is, this doesn't mean no assessment. Assessing learning is very different than grading learning. Assessing learning is how we move forward. But so just think about it this way. If you remember those old speed limit signs, when you drove by them and it would show you your speed and it'd be like speed limit 25, you drive by, it says you're going 42, slow down. Cool. That is good feedback and assessment. That gives you personal information so you can adjust your learning, your behavior. Cool. Imagine if you drove by that sign, it said 25 miles an hour, you're going C+. There's no inherent information in here. I mean, that just as you're going similar to everyone else. Cool. I don't know what the hell I'm supposed to do with that information, so I'm just going to keep on speeding. That's what great. There's no inherent information. So we keep assessment. We keep feedback. We keep this kind of formative standards-based thing where it's, even if it's dichotomous, yes, you've met a level, no, you haven't. But nowhere in this process does a grade, does a rank ever need to occur. Unless we accept that, yes, I'm ranking my kids for Harvard to make it easier for Harvard. But I promise you, if COVID taught us anything, it's that once you stop giving grades to kids, watch when university sector, it'll take them 2 to 3 months to adapt and they'll say, cool, we're going to go grade free. And instead of giving me a GPA, every kid is going to have to give me a portfolio or something like that. And it was the COVID was it was when they lost SATs. Every college scrambled and said, what are we going to do without SATs? And there was a great podcast, This American Life. If you haven't, they had an entire hour on this one thing where they were talking to admissions people. And they said, yeah, it took us about 2 months to adjust our admissions process and a little more time every night that we had to study the actual applications. But in the end, we actually feel a little bit better this year. Like, I feel like I know the applicants more than I did when we had an SAT. I feel like I'm paid more attention to who they are. 2 months, that's all it took for the world to adjust to no SATs.
Yeah.
It will be the same thing when it comes to grades, I guarantee.
But I think that's where I appreciate your text, because it takes a disruption to significantly adjust practice. You know, you can create a burning platform in a system where, oh my gosh, our kids aren't learning, our kids aren't doing, our kids aren't, but everyone doesn't adjust to it, because in education, this is a safe profession. So you don't radically change your practice. Now, the pandemic, radical change in practice, right? I mean, yeah. We're doing activities with staff of, you know, what did you do and learn and what are you going to keep in your practice? And then what did you eliminate that you're just never going to bring back? And
yeah.
Rating, to your point, is one of those interesting things. And I love the idea of the speed limit sign with the built-in radar that shows you your speed as you're approaching it, mostly because I usually accelerate when I see those to see how quickly I can go before it freezes up.
You want to rank me? All right, screw it. Let's see what we can
rank
do.
This. A plus, baby, 55 yeah. and 25.
And it's interesting. If you pull that back, I think this is a good point, because a lot of people are also talking about errors. Like, that's a big thing in education now. How do I get kids to embrace mistakes, failure? And you start to see the error is only meaningful in a learning situation. It's not meaningful in a performance situation. When I'm performing brain surgery, and I don't perform it, I just do the mapping. But let's say I was performing brain surgery. Error is the last thing you want. If I'm doing open heart surgery or I'm landing a jumbo jet, a mistake, that's not a learning situation. That's death. In a performance situation, errors are bad. In a learning situation, that's when errors are good. When I'm practicing surgery, when I'm practicing how to fly a plane, when I'm practicing basketball, that screw up left and right, that's when you're going to get good. So that's where you get to pull back and say, okay, school by and large should be a learning institution. And that's why we want kids to embrace errors. None of this, we're learning. None of this is a performance. It doesn't matter yet. This is how we get to performance ready. The problem is when you include grades, all school is a performance. It moves from being a learning institution to a performance institution. A grade says, regardless of what you're doing, we are ranking you against your peers. Ergo, you've got to outperform everyone. And in that situation, errors are horrible. You make an error, you lose a ranking. That's a bad thing. So for all of us who are really gung-ho on getting kids to embrace mistakes and errors, we have to recognize we've built a context that dictates to them that, no, it's not okay to screw up. We can tell them till the cows come home, yeah, screw up, fail forward, it's great. But until we have the context that says, by the way, that is okay to do, they'll continue to be totally afraid of it, as they should be. I hated errors growing up because then I wouldn't be top of my class, and then I'd look like an idiot, and then I wouldn't get into school, and my parents would ground me. So grades turn school from a learning institution into a performance institution. And in so doing, that harms a lot of the other things we try and hope to get out of students.
Yeah. With grades, you know, you wonder if we can do a full blown historical reset, because the whole institution is mapped around compliance for, you are now of age to begin school, but not developmentally appropriate, maybe, because now I'm five like everybody else, but I just got potty trained. I have different motivations. Yet that cohort stays together, gets sorted and ranked, and then moved forward. And you see that with, you know, when you have children, like our son's a June 22nd birthday and he's going to school with a June 23rd birthday, who's a year older than him. Yeah. And that's a big deal when you are six on the same day that the other kid turned five. And then they're graded and they're sorted and they're moved forward. So
You see it in sports. It's real easy to see in sports. It's the same thing. You put a kid who's June 22nd and a kid who's June 23rd the year before or the year after on the same exact sports team, hands down. And this isn't this. We got all the stats for this. The older kids will outperform the younger kids and they get better opportunities. And you have more people in professional sports born in a specific month due solely to that fact that when they were young, they were playing 1 year above the people they were playing with.
Right, right.
And everyone's like, cool, sports. Yeah, that makes sense. That's sport. It's the same thing with cognition. There is no difference there whatsoever. So if you've got a young five-year-old with a young six-year-old in the same class, purely developmentally, you'll see a different trajectory. But what's going to happen is that six-year-old might get more opportunity, might move. And then all of a sudden, you, as you said, you spent 12 years just behind these other people going,
But that leads to, you know, all of the, you know, post neuroscience stuff, right? That leads to emotions, that leads to confidence, and it leads to your ability to be successful, which leads me to chapter four, homework.
Homework.
Homework. So Jared, I have to just tell you this story real quick. I was a young principal, large middle school, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, 1,000 kids. And the two issues I dealt with the most were number one, compliance issues. Kids, you know, I'm not sitting there, you know, and they get kicked out of class, not being prepared for class. So number one was relationships. Number two was compliance around homework. So one day I decided with my assistant principal, because our copier budget was so crazy, I asked our assistant principal to tell the, to work with the ladies who were making all the photocopies. And I said, I want you to pull one sample of all of the things you're photocopying just for a week and put them in a file folder for me.
Yeah.
At the end of the week, this file folder, at least 7-8 inches deep with photocopies, right? Because there's 70 some teachers giving homework every day. And then we went through and we audited how much of the homework was application of new knowledge or practice. Yeah. And then how much of it was like worksheets, say like, you know, word searches, you know, compliance and coloring of maps. It was like 85-15 of application, 15% application, 85% compliance packet, busy stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So I came to a faculty meeting. I showed them. I did. We did a gallery. We put it all over the walls. We said, go around and look at all of this homework. We ended up doing the same thing when I became director of learning for the whole district with final exams. And
love this. That's a cool idea.
Oh my gosh. It was fascinating because everyone did the same thing I did when I started reading your book. They got in a defensive posture. Parents demand homework. Parents expect homework. Parents. Yeah, but all we do all day long is fight with kids. You want me to, you want us to retain children because they don't fill out your map packet or do your crossword puzzles because it's compliant. It leads to a broken relationship. Well, when you went homework, the problem with opportunity cost, what were some of your findings? Because my experience was this is a war where people are willing to die on some weird hills.
Yeah.
And I thought as a teacher, like, I'm telling you, you can eliminate homework. And they're like, what would I do with my free time?
It's funny. It's the hills that everyone in this argument are willing to die on, oddly enough, are never their own. So teachers do it because they think parents want it done. Parents want it because they think school administrators want it. School administrators do it because they think teachers want it. Everyone just assumes that everyone else really demands this stuff. But the joke is, if you really start interviewing people, no one wants it. There's not a single person in the world who's like, yeah, I love fighting with my kids to get them to do their homework. Man, that is just fun stuff. And teachers, like you were saying, great, I love losing my weekend to grading homework. Why? Because it just makes me feel, no one wants it. But we continue to do it. And this is what, just a great example of, because we've always done it, we're just going to continue to do it. If we stop and just ask questions about it, we might decide, yeah, we want to keep homework, in which case, cool. But if you stop and eliminate this need, we have to do it because we've always done it, and just say, what purpose is it serving? You might come out with a new answer, which says maybe we don't really need it all that much. So I think if you really look at, so there's a lot of arguments you can make around homework. And I think the two big ones that I've taken out, aside from the fact that we found that no one really wants it, kids, and you get that question, imagine you eliminated, who would suffer? Do you think parents would yell? Do you think you would yell? Do you think administrators, do you think kids would care? No one's really going to care. But with that said, then you get to say, okay, but does it serve a purpose when we, if we talk about learning? And from there, there's kind of two angles. One is you say it helps kids develop responsibility, a sense of self-autonomy, of control. And I love it. Like that feels right. Until you go look in the research, there is absolutely zero. And I don't mean like a little bit and maybe one small study done in the 60s. There has not been a single study done that links self-efficacy to homework. And there's been five studies that have done correlations, and they find a correlation, but they rightly say that it's probably the other way around, where kids with responsibility do the homework rather than the homework driving the responsibility.
Well, and that's where your neighbor Howard in the cubicles there, he, you know, some of those meta-analysis studies showed very quickly there's zero correlation between skill acquirement, success, and homework completion.
Oh, so, oh, Hattie. Oh, you're thinking, so you Hattie, said Howard is a guard. Yeah, no, yeah, John, yeah. And when you, so that's a great recognition where you just go, look, it's not making you a better person to do homework. In which case, then you have to fall back on the rest, which just says, does it at least help you learn? And then you can see when it comes to younger years, primary years, unless you have support, no, it doesn't really drive learning. So if you've got parents willing to help a primary school kid, then you're going to get benefit. But those are probably the parents that are reading to them anyway, going to help them. It's the kids that don't have the parental support that probably need it the most, that homework is going to have no impact, in which case you're just giving them stress for no reason. So, but when you get up into upper years, so middle years, high school, that's when you start to see an impact of homework, but not in the way most people think. It turns out, and I think this is my favorite finding I found, is if you take a look at, most people assume more homework, better grades or better learning outcomes. And it turns out it's an inverted U, is at about, you peak your learning at about 90 minutes, in which case, once you go homework beyond 90 minutes, learning actually starts to drop to the point where kids who are doing homework for 3 to 4 hours a night are learning as little as people who do 10 to 15 minutes of homework a night. 4 hours versus 10 minutes, you get the same exact outcome. So where's the sweet spot? You tend to see that most of the growth is done in that first 60 minutes. So if you assume, okay, most of our learning takes place in 60 minutes of homework, and the most important thing from that is frequency is more important than quantity. So here's where you see, so long as your homework is 5 to 10 minutes max, if you even do it at all, of locking down skills, of saying, here's a skill we need to keep drilling it, apply it to this new, here's a transfer problem, you know math, apply it to this new thing, rather than learning like the flipped classroom. Here's brand new info. Once you do a flipped classroom, by the way, can I just, that is my bugbear. That is my, I'm going to get on a soapbox here. Do you mind if I soapbox for a second?
Yes, everybody pull over in your car. It's about to get nuts.
This is, people are talking about flipped classrooms like they're new, like somehow technology invented that. We had to read chapters at night. That's a flipped classroom. When your teacher's like, go read chapter 3. We're going to talk about it tomorrow. Question, did you ever read chapter 3? Course not. Why? Because you knew your teacher would still have to teach it the next day, because she knew that half the class wouldn't have read it and she can't move forward until she at least covers it. Flipped classroom has always been around and it has never been effective. And so finally, we just ran a huge analysis to see what the heck is going on. And the big take home is flipped classrooms, flipped learning only works when the teacher teaches the material explicitly the following day, which is what we've all intuitively known.
But Jared,
you can tell your kids to go. Yeah, yeah.
Jared, do you know the people who did read chapter 3 the night before? What they grew up to be?
Teachers?
Yes.
That is
which is why it is so hard for teachers to shift the practice, because they did do that stuff. I will do an activity where I will put up a consensogram. So it's a poster up on the wall, and it shows GPAs, 4.0, 3.5 to 3.9, 3 to 3.4. It goes all the way down. I'll give everybody a little sticker dot, And it just creates immediate visual evidence. I want you to go up there and put up your GPA at the end of high school. Oh, preponderance of evidence is always 3 to 4.0.
Yeah, yeah.
Most of them 3.5 to 4. And then a couple of lunkers who I want to hang out with, right? People like me, 2.1, 2.2, 2.3, who didn't play school well. So when you challenge that ingrained group of people who are motivated, and I realize I'm casting a broad swath here, but who were intrinsically motivated to do all of those things, to put a little extra glitter on their poster, to go to the 3 minutes in the presentation, they don't want to be moved off of that because that's what worked well for them.
Yeah.
So with that, because we only have a couple of minutes left, you have to go to class.
Oh, right? Shoot. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So with that mindset, what are you doing messing with mindset? We're all in love with growth mindset, man. And then you come along and you're like air out of the balloon. So tell us about that.
So mindset, what I'll say, okay, there's nothing inherently wrong with mindset. I love mindset as much as the next guy. It's just we have to be very reasonable with what we can expect from mindset. And the problem by and large with mindset theory and education is, and here's the joke, Dweck and Hattie and all the bigwigs will say, you as teachers have misinterpreted mindset. You didn't understand what we were saying and you started using it wrong. But what I was hopefully able to clearly point out in this chapter is no, it was never misinterpreted. It was misrepresented by the researchers themselves. We were flat out told by Carol Dweck and her followers that mindset will boost learning. When kids have a better mindset, their learning, their academic skills, their abilities will improve. And I'm sorry, but we've got plenty of evidence. I don't know how much more evidence we need to get. Like, we're talking 2 decades worth of work here that shows the correlation between mindset and academic outcomes is very little. It's higher in the younger years, but by the time you get up to like university level, it's 0.02. It's non-existent. But more importantly, when you run mindset interventions, so I'm going to take your mindset, I'm going to give you a growth mindset, and now track your learning, there's no impact. It doesn't change their learning. And here's where you see that mindset is still very important for things like confidence. And by the way, it's important purely because it's true. I want kids to have a growth mindset, the same reason I want them to believe the earth is round, because it's true. There is no reason to believe anything else. I don't need you to believe in a growth mindset because it's going to make you a better learner. I'm going to need you to believe it the same. I'm going to need you to believe that A squared plus B squared equals C squared. It's just a simple fact about how the brain works, that it is adaptive and anyone can improve any skill. That's not even a question anymore. But the joke is once you get to that level, everyone assumes, well, now you're going to learn better. And it just doesn't. Past that level, you still have to do what we call effective teaching and learning practices. And it's weird, but give me a kid with a bad mindset, but I go through effective teaching and learning practices, they will learn. Give me a kid with the best mindset in the world, and if they sit on their thumb in the corner, they ain't going to learn a thing. So here's where we just have to reframe mindset and say it is an appetizer. It's an entry into learning. It might speed up the learning process ultimately, but it doesn't absolve us from having to go through the learning process. And that's where me and Carol Dweck, she still said it. And she had an interview about a year ago where she flat out said it did my head in, where somebody finally called her out on and said, you continue to say that the impact of mindset on learning is remarkable. When we have the evidence here that says, give me 15 million, or give me 1,500,000 kids, 500,000 kids. So 1.5 million kids are failing a class in the US, we'll say this year. I give them a mindset intervention, the ones that you have prescribed and built for me, 1.425 million of them will still fail. It doesn't have the impact people are claiming it has. And that might be okay, but at that level, we start to recognize this isn't a teaching or a learning strategy. It's a mental game, and that's fine, but we can't use it for what it's not intended for. We just have to be very explicit what we can expect from it.
Right, and I think the powerful thing about mindset is if you can attach tactics to it, where you can show people, okay, now you believe you can do it. Now let's build the strengths around you so that you can do it, right? One of the best analogies I had ever heard was, I believe that I could be a starting forward at Manchester United, but I do not have the physical makeup, I'm 50 years old, but I can run around believing that. But tactically, what are we going to do to build me up to actually be that and do that? And to your point, I mean, I've been doing a ton of reading around behavioral science lately, and I just did my last podcast on it. And it, you know, belief gets you to the finish line, but it's the preparation that propels you to it. And that, I mean, there's your next book, man. You've got the research, you've got all those great graduates and undergrads. They can do all that work for you at the University of Melbourne. So
make them work. It's funny. And I think that's a good point to make too, before we tail out, is confidence breeds success. It's not the other way around. Excuse me. I flipped that seat. Even that's how weird it is. Even I know what I'm trying to say, and it comes back. Yeah. Success breeds confidence, not the other way around. You get a mindset when you're demonstrated that you can succeed at something, rather than the mindset helps you succeed. So that's why we keep coming back to effective learning and teaching will help a kid develop a growth mindset without you even having to do a thing. But teaching them a growth mindset isn't going to have the same impact. It doesn't, that argument doesn't flip around. Right. And so I love mindset as much as the next guy. It's just, when you dive into it, it ain't what people think it is.
It's that great research that shows that the difference between how you reinforce with your kids. If you continually tell your kids they're really smart versus you tell your children that they try really hard, the kids who you've told you've tried really hard accelerate in life. And the ones who have been told their whole life they're super smart continually fall short of their own goals and don't get there. And
give a kid a high IQ at age 8 and watch when they plateau at age 12.
Right.
That's because why would I have to work? I have a high IQ. Well, that didn't really do much anything for you.
Yeah, that ticket's cashed early in life. You have to keep working for it. So,
yeah.
Jared, thank you so much. The book is 10 Things Schools Get Wrong. You can get it on Amazon, and you can follow Jared Horvath on Twitter, and you can also find his work all over the place. I feel almost like you and I should just start a weekly turn on the microphone, drop a topic, and have a conversation, and then post it for the world to hear, because I enjoy talking to you so much. So, Jared, thank you.
Me too. I always love this. Thank you so much. I'm always up for that. We'll make a YouTube channel.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. But then we'll have to like have fake fights and stuff to increase impressions.
And we always have to comb our hair too, because then people can see us. We'll stick with the podcast.
All right, man. Well, enjoy your time with your students. It's Friday morning by you. It's Thursday night by me. You have a great
day. Thank you, sir. Have a good night. I'll see you soon.
Yeah. Get his book and follow him. All right. Be well,
Jared. Thanks, guys. Bye, y'all.
See ya.
So let's do some smart thinking. List assumptions you have about our traditions in education. Describe a few things you can do differently as a result of the conversation between Jared and myself. And list one thing you will share with others as a result of this conversation. All right, that's it. That's the Smart Thinking Podcast. Hey, as always, thank you for listening, and thank you to the Well Pennies for the great music. Jared, for taking the time to have this conversation with me. He is one of my favorite neuroscientists and authors to speak with. And for you. Thank you for listening, and please make sure to share this on your own smart thinking platform. All right, everybody, as we head into your week and the summer, those of you who are in education, take time to truly reflect on what are the legacy pieces that we're holding on to that maybe we need to challenge? What are some things that we do need to do different? What are some traditions that maybe it's time for them to be polished a little bit, if not taken away? What can we do different in order to be better for the students that we serve so that we can greet them as they enter their newest year of school and make sure that their diploma has weight? Instead of it being a receipt of a past journey, it is a ticket to their future. Take this opportunity to truly reflect on where is it that we can get better so that we can serve children and students in our schools in ways that they deserve.
Hold on, what are you dreaming of? Long gone, lost in a summer love. Go wild, go be as you are. time.